Welcome to another episode of the Carry Trainer Higher Line Podcast. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Higher Line Podcast. We've got our friend John Correa on here. You've probably seen him before if you've ever perused the internet looking for information on self-protection, which is part of the name of his YouTube channel, Active Self-Protection. How are you, sir?
I'm wonderful, man. Every day's a holiday and every meal's a feast. How you doing?
Ooh, that's pretty good. Every day's a holiday, every meal's a feast. Pat McNamara likes to say something to the effect of, every morning's a Monday and every evening's a Friday. Same kind of.
So I learned it from my grandpa, who was a Marine in the 50s. And the full saying is every day's a holiday, every meal's a feast, every formation's a parade, and every paycheck's a fortune.
Oh, I like that.
But if somebody remembers it, one of the characters on Alien, the Marine character on the movie Alien, with Sigourney Weaver, actually says that too. So if they know it, they're like, oh, you're an old school fan. I'm like, well, actually, I learned it from my grandpa, who learned it in the Marine Corps. You know, it's another fine day in the United States Marine Corps. So
that's a good attitude. It's a nice way to start the day. It's a good attitude.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you say, hey, wait a minute, life is grand and I just got to live in that instead of life sucks and I got to endure it, then I think it gets better.
Is your grandpa still around?
No. Grandpa passed away in 94 doing what he loved best. And he was a bricklayer for 41 years after he got out of the Corps. And I worked for him for the last 7 years that the business, or 6 years that the business existed. And man lived on his own terms and died on his own terms. So life is good.
That's good. So you were like a brick laborer? Were you in the business doing laboring and such?
Yeah. I worked for him for, like I say, about the last 6 years. So if I tell you the whole story, people will laugh. So my grandpa actually did 3.5 years for attempted murder because he shot a guy who beat my grandma up, but he shot him a long while after. So he found out who did it and went and hunted him down and shot him in the face with a .357.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, hit him right in the middle of the forehead with a .357 Magnum, and dude's head was back, and so it split his scalp and rang his bell, but didn't kill him. And so Grandpa did 3.5 years for attempted murder from the time that I was 10 until I was 13. And when he got out when I was 13, I started going to work for him in the summers and on weekends and vacations and stuff like that. So I was a hod carrier for a couple years. And then he made me into an apprentice bricklayer. And so I laid brick for a while. And then I was a foreman on the job site for a couple years, which was kind of fun at 16, 17 years old. When you're the foreman of a job site with a bunch of 30-year-old men, but I knew more than most of them and had the interest of the business in mind. And then kind of not ran the business, but ran the business end of it for him at 18. And then he passed away when I was 18. So, and then he actually gave me the business. So my grandma, when he passed away, is like, oh, grandpa definitely wanted you to have the business. But in the 90s in Sacramento, California, and in the Central Valley in California, man, the construction trade was cutthroat, like beyond cutthroat. And I was like, I don't want nothing to do with that. I'm not living that life. I see what the numbers are. And so my uncle ended up taking it over and working the trades. And grandpa didn't really, he wanted me to kind of have that experience, but he didn't want me in the trades. And so he wanted me to go to college. So I followed what grandpa said, went to college for a while. And then I joined the military and screwed all that up. So I laid brick for a while. I don't know that I would want to do it for a living.
I'm a fifth generation carpenter, so I can relate to that. I labored as a brickie for 2 or 3 summers, so that's man work for sure.
It's good, honest work, man. And as a kid, as a teenager, I made crazy money for a teenager. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, just crazy money working all summer for my grandpa, especially because, in California in the 90s. Oh, yeah, I mean, I remember that was one of our jokes that my freshman year, before my freshman year of high school, I worked for him all summer. And the football coach, you know, when school started up, was like, well, how come you haven't been in the gym all summer? And I'm like, coach, I've been doing a whole lot more than these guys in the gym. I've been working 10, 11 hour days, you know, building buildings.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, I don't know some of these guys that can take a 60 pound cinder block and throw it up two flights of scaffolding to the next guy and freaking sling mud all day. And he was like, yep, come on, GM, come on.
Yeah, and it's not just one time. It's one after another, after another, after another. Yeah. Yep. So then you went in the Navy before or after college?
Well, I went to college for a couple semesters. and realized I was just kind of going to college because I was supposed to go to college, you know, because I was a smart kid. So I went for a while, and then the money kind of ran out and I was kind of listless. And so talked to my parents, talked to my grandparents. My grandpa, on my mom's side, was a World War II Marine, fought under Chesty Puller and wounded in the assault on Peleliu. And so he wouldn't let me join the Marine Corps because he said I was too smart. And so I ended up joining the Navy right in then about 95. served in the Navy from 95 to 02, had a really weird Navy career, 8 years in the Navy and 7 days at sea. Even in a seagoing rate, learned how to served on the USS John C. Stennis for a little while, and then got out at the end of 02 and transitioned from that, went to graduate school, moved here to Phoenix to go to graduate school and for pastoring, in fact, seminary. So did that and pastored a church for 14 years between two different churches. And then started active self-protection in 2011, had those overlapping for a while. So for a while, I was working three jobs. I was running active self-protection just as a little fun side hustle, and then working full-time in vocational ministry, and then part-time as a professor as well, as an adjunct professor. So I adjuncted for about 9 years. And now it's all in on ASP starting at the beginning of 2018.
So you pastored a church and did the active self-protection. Did you have any parishioners think, hey, what are you doing? Were they all on board?
Yeah, I mean, you're always going to have that, right? Because, of course, my church ago, never was a...
Go ahead.
It never was a gun church, right? So some people would expect, it's the gun pastor, whatever. But that's not who we were. We were just regular folks, and, you know, a regular non-denominational congregation like many. And, I did. I mean, I remember this is probably 08. I bought my first AR-15, and I put some pictures on my Facebook, my personal Facebook, of my wife shooting it. And that made a family in our church leave the congregation. And,
Were you in California then, or were you in Arizona?
No, Arizona. Arizona. Okay. Arizona's pretty, it's the most gun friendly state in the union, right? I mean, we have the best firearms laws in America, but even still, you know, you're going to get people on all sides of the spectrum there. And I respected that family, and we talked about it, and they're like, you know, this is just a big deal. They had a daughter who was murdered with a firearm. And so that was, you know, really hard for them. And I'm like, okay, let me help you find a good congregation that meets your needs, whatever. Pretty quick. I mean, most people knew who I was. I'm not hiding that. So they knew I was concealed carrying at church and those kinds of things. But I didn't preach sermons about the Second Amendment, and we didn't, we didn't do that kind of stuff. So, I'm grateful for my time in ministry and vocational ministry. I don't think I'll ever run a church again. I think that, I love shepherding. I love being a pastor, but I hate running nonprofit. Running a church part of being a pastor is something that I don't find in the Bible. But it's a part of the job description that you just got to do. And I'm like, nah, I'm good, fam. I'm just going to go
talk about that for a second. Just because I think that's an interesting topic. My father was a minister for my whole life. So you said the pastoring part you don't find in the Bible. Let me hear about that.
No. So the being a shepherd and pastoring, right? So that's what, the pastor is one who is in the pasture, right? The one who is shepherding the sheep. And so that is absolutely biblical, right? And taking care of people's souls and their lives and living life with them and teaching them to, follow the way of Jesus and live for the one true King. And that's all what that is like in scripture. But in modern America, for the vast majority of churches, the pastor also has to run the business. He has to.
I got you. That's what I thought you meant.
Yeah, has to run the entire organization. So you have this entire nonprofit that you have to run. You have to be aware of employment law and business principles and hiring contractors and volunteer coordination and all the Robert's rules of order and run meetings and sit committees and do all these things,
right?
Not to mention
have a building and keep toilet paper in the bathrooms and yeah.
And I mean, who's gonna? Okay, so the nursery coordinator is burned out because, of course, she is, and so she decided that she's stepping down from that. So who's gonna volunteer as tribute next? And how are we gonna have enough childcare for this activity? And how are we gonna make sure that our youth group, game isn't going to kill a child? And we got to look over the insurance documents for this thing, and all that stuff. At the end of the day, has nothing to do with what the job actually is of shepherding. And so I decided, and through much prayer and much discussion, that I wanted to do the parts of the job that I loved. I wanted to shepherd souls. I wanted to help people live life in good times and bad, but I didn't want to do all that run the nonprofit anymore. And so I let the job go at the beginning of February 1st, 2018. And so I still do it. I actually have a little house church that meets here in our house a couple times a month. I shepherd souls, try to everywhere I go. But, and my biggest thing is I live for Jesus, man.
What does it mean to shepherd souls? What do you mean by that?
And I
just want to make sure, people, cause not everybody that listens to this will know who you are. And then some people only know you from ASP. And I don't know if you're always, having these same types of discussions there.
Yeah, probably not in this much detail on ASP often. I talk about spiritual fitness on ASP quite a bit. Whenever we have a good person who loses a deadly force encounter, I talk about the fact that you want to make sure you've said everything you need to say to your loved ones, that they know that you love them, that you've solved every conflict you can, and that you have lived a good life, and that you want to make sure that you and Jesus have a strong relationship, because on that day, on that last day of your life, you will absolutely need it, and it will be too late to get. So get it now. And what I mean by shepherding souls is that human beings are more than our physical bodies, that we are body, soul, and spirit. And, or at the very least body and soul, depending on how you want to see things. And that's theology, and we can get into that all day long. But that soul side is, and soul care and personal care of people, I think is important. And, so that is things like, how do I decide what my priorities are? How do I weather the storm of difficulty? How do I, how do I find meaning and significance in life? How do I love my spouse well? How do I raise children in such a way that helps them prepare for their journey in the world? And how do I arrange my soul such that I am doing the right things in the right way for the right reasons? So soul care is really where that boils down to, and providing that for people and being there for them in good times and bad. So, I mean, as the pastor, the best part of the job is, when a family has a baby, you're the first one who doesn't have their last name who gets to visit and hold that baby, because they want pastor to hold their baby. You get to be there. You're the guy that at the wedding gets to sneak back and pray with the bride beforehand and pray with the groom and be there with them in their premarital mentorship. So then that way, they're ready for marriage, not just for a big party. You get the phone call when somebody gets the cancer diagnosis. And John, I don't know what to do. Okay, man, let's talk and let's pray and let's think and let's trust. And, you get the call when, Hey, John, mom's gone home to be with the Lord, and, we're hurting. Okay, I'll be right over. And to sit with people while they grieve. You get the, my wife just left me and I don't know how to deal with this. Okay. So let's sit down and let's think about what's the right thing to do. So the good times and bad, you get to be there. And those are, beautiful things and incredible, blessing. And I love all that stuff. And I still get to do that, specifically with people here in my local community and good friends, but, I get to do that without the garbage of going, ooh, I can't really go over there because I have a business meeting I have to moderate here in an hour.
Mm-hmm. I actually, I have a friend, CJ Ortiz. He's, on Facebook or Instagram. He's the metal motivator. And he was a minister back like in the 80s, I want to say. And he's got a really good rap about how he feels. And I don't want to offend anybody, but he's got a rap about how he feels that the modern church in America is really bad for families because it takes up so much time and resources. And what he's talking about is what you're talking about. All of that other stuff that is totally ancillary to like the parts inside of us, the building, all the, everything has got to be a special interest now, like gardening club and motorcycle club and karate club. And, it's all cool because you're trying to include people and make them feel welcome, but it's just now somebody's got to manage all that. And you got to have emails and printed materials and just stuff. And it's not,
yeah, and activities. So I think some churches, they now not everyone, but some churches, if we say what's our product and we make disciples, followers of the one true King, right? We introduce people to the living God and help them learn to follow him. But we mistake participation in activities for being taught to follow Jesus. And when we do that, then we get people involved in activities and we measure success by how many people did we attract to our activities rather than how many disciples did we make and how many people did we help to change the inside of their soul to follow Jesus. It's much harder to measure. So when we get stuck on our measurables like that, then we get people, we want to have the motorcycle club that meets at our church because bringing those people around, then we get to pray for them, then that makes them disciples of Jesus. And I go, does it really? You know, we're going to go for a motorcycle ride and I'm down, you know, but did that help? Did it do something? Like, you know?
Yeah. Not to mention now your church is stealing people from your neighbor's church. I use the word stealing, but it's become it's marketing, man. Like growing your YouTube channel or your business, it's marketing. You need customers, which is parishioners, and then you have to do things to entice them. Like, hey, at our church, we just have church on Sunday and Thursday night, but over there they've got motorcycle club and gardening club and better coffee for after service. Like it becomes
and a smoke machine.
Yeah. What amenities do we have and how can we, we start our classes out and I do this a lot myself when I wake up in the morning. What's my goal? I talk about this with the people that train with us. What's your goal? Like, why are you here today? What do you want to get out of it? And I do it when I get up. Like, what do I got to do today? Not just like, what are my to-do things, but when I lay my head down tonight, what will make me feel I lived a good day today? And I think that's maybe the same thing. Is motorcycle club what I need, which isn't bad, or do I have something else I'm trying to do?
Yeah, and like, in my own life, everybody's got to set their own goals, right? And what makes for a great day for them? For me, like, for instance, every morning I get up, use the bathroom, whatever, but then I go empty the dishwasher.
Let's talk a little more about that, John.
Pour myself a cup of coffee after I empty the dishwasher and then go sit out on my back porch and spend a little time in prayer, a little time in scripture. So then that way my soul is correctly set for the day. And I say, all right, Jesus, what do you want me to get done today? How does that work? And once I orient my soul towards the day, now I orient my life towards the day. When I don't do that, my wife can tell, I'll be being a grumpy butthole or something. And she's like, hey, did you just spend some time with the Lord this morning? No, why? Rawr, okay, maybe, I don't know, might be something you might want to do. I don't know. So, that's how I start my day every day. And I do the same thing you do then. I look, back at the end of the day and I go, okay, so was today a meaningful day? Was today invested or was today spent?
Yeah.
And hopefully every day we can say it was invested.
I think that a friend of mine says that all the time. Don't spend your time invested. Don't spend your time invested. And it's too easy. Like we all do it. I just got to get through the workday and then I can get home and I can enjoy. I just got to get through this meeting. I just got to get through this traffic. I just got to spend. And you're not putting anything back in. Yeah, that's harsh.
It's one of those things where like some changes that I've made, like Greg Elifritz, who's a nationally respected known trainer and a friend, really challenged me with how many books he reads, so a couple of years ago, I was like, okay, how do I up my reading time so that I can do that? And one of the ways that I found to do that was using audiobooks, and I travel a lot to teach classes and take classes. And so, man, if I'm sitting on an airplane, I've got my headphones in and I'm listening to an audiobook rather than just kind of sitting in La La Land while I'm on an airplane. Because you go, dude, I've got 4 hours to get from here to there. And so what am I going to do with that 4 hours? Let me, sit and take some notes and think and learn through things. So that path of personal development has been, I think, really important. And guys like you and like Greg have really tried to emulate and go, okay, what can I take here to make me a better person, to make me more focused on making sure. And don't get me wrong. I love to sit at the end of the day and like turn the boob tube on and like turn my brain off a little bit. And I think we all do. And having recreation is important, but not having that drive your day. How do I get better today? How do I improve and make a difference in the lives of people today?
Mm-hmm. I think an interesting thing I've noticed in myself, I can't speak for others. I don't feel that I need to shut my brain off as much. Like it's not like I just need a beer and watch some Netflix when I've spent the day productively and I'm not just burning and running in 30 directions when I've got a set of finite goals or plans and I can hammer it out. I don't get to the end of the day and I'm not playing on this thing all day long, because you know how that can just, right, you know, suck hours out of your life. Then I don't get to the end of the day and feel like garbage.
Right. I think you're right. I think when you're in, to me, it's about kind of stress too. Like if I'm not, if I'm doing things that I feel competent and good at and they don't stress me out, that I don't feel like I'm over my limits of what I can handle, then usually I'm chill. I don't need to turn my brain off. It's that when I have too many tasks to do, or the tasks seem overwhelming, or I don't feel competent to them, then that's when at the end of the day I go, man, I need a beer and some Netflix.
Yeah. Let's change gears a little bit. So you started Active Self-Protection, you say 2011 or 2008?
2011, I started the business, yep.
2008 is when you bought your first AR?
Correct. I started carrying a handgun concealed in 2006. Bought my first AR when Barack Obama got elected. That was the tipping point for me. So I guess it was actually the end of 07 that I bought my first AR. And or maybe 08. I guess it was the end of 08. Anyways. Started the business because I started training a little bit and saying, okay, wait a minute. I realized pretty quick in 06, I started training martial arts as well. My son dragged me into it. And it wasn't too long after that that I said, man, if I'm going to carry this gun, I need to be competent with it. So I started training, taking a few classes here and there, local guys, and then realized, man, this gets expensive. And, buying range ammo and finding a better gun and, doing the things that make you actually live this out gets expensive. So how can I write this off? And I've always kind of had entrepreneurial streak. I've had side hustles most of my life. And so I just started teaching. I thought, man, how do I maybe teach a few classes and then at least I can write ammo off and write my own training off as continual education. And so that's why I started the business in 2011. Went down and got my NRA certs, which is, you know, most people's entry into firearms instruction in 2011. And so that's when the business officially started. Started the social media presence of the business in 2013 on Facebook. Had the YouTube channel in 2013, but literally did nothing with it until April of 2016. So really the YouTube channel is 4 years old, 4 years and a little bit old now. Started that really in April of 16 and it's boomed from there. So now it's,
yeah, it's crazy. What are you up to now for subscribers? A million what?
About almost 1.8 million on the big channel. Awesome. So big channel has 1.79 million right now. And, the second channel has about 113,000 today. Facebook page has almost 300,000 likes on it. So the big thing on the big YouTube channel isn't even the subscribers. So, I mean, subscribers are great, but watch they don't time. Pay. Number one, you don't get paid for subscribers. Yeah. Number two, I can buy subscribers. I can buy them for $5 for 1,000 of them. I'd never do that. That's death to your channel. But sure. You can, and but we average right now, I think in the last 28 days, the channel's had about 22 million views. So that's pretty average and typical for us. Somewhere in the 20 to 30 million view range is pretty typical for us. So right now, and lifetime channel has about almost 800 million views lifetime at this point. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a huge number. And so when I say, I said this on Extra, I put up a video on the second channel, we call it Extra, Active Self-Protection Extra, about 1911s. And it was just the other day that, you know, hey, if you're going to, basically the premise of the video, sitting at a gun shop, if you're going to buy, if you want to carry a 1911, it needs to be a really good one and they're really expensive. And I said, listen, I train about 300 students a year on the line, give or take, in handgun classes. And then I train millions every year online. And this guy's like, you train millions online? That's garbage. And I was like, well, somebody doesn't know what I do on my big channel, pretty obviously, right? So, which is fine. I mean, I don't expect everybody to know who I am. But yeah, I mean, somewhere in that neighborhood of around, we get about 6 or 7 million unique watchers a month, which is pretty
cool. That's cool. Yeah, it's interesting. The community of people, I've been involved in this in some way, shape, or form for 20 years. I worked with our state, Illinois Department of Natural Resources, doing hunter safety education years ago. And I got a bunch of younger brothers, so I like working with kids. I like hunting. But there's like sects of people that follow. Like somebody sent me a message last night. We need more inclusion in the Second Amendment community. And I said, why do we have to have a Second Amendment community? Like, can't people just like, why do I have to be like a community? Can't I like, could I not be like a raging liberal and still have a gun? Like, can I not do that? But anyway,
100% yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My point was just, there's like, you saw that Taurus video we did last year.
And oh boy.
People don't like data. Like, there's a famous 2011 maker right now. I don't want to say their name because a lot of my friends shoot them and have them, and I don't want to insult them. But I see them every month in class break, and they're very expensive. They cost more than my first car, and they're beautiful. But they are not built for the kind of things that we do when we're training thousands of rounds a year. Or that Taurus.
Yep.
I have got more messages. If anybody's interested, go to the video we've got on our YouTube channel and just look at the comments. You're a freaking idiot. You're a da da da. It's like, I didn't make this up. I bought the gun. I shot it. You watch it not work over and over again in the video. Pull the trigger. It doesn't go bang.
What do you want me to do?
Yeah. What do you? And so then.
You want me to lie to you?
Yeah. That's disingenuous. You should have sent it back and got another one. So now I got to go out of my way to make you feel good because you purchased something that's not ideal. Like
So here's my thought on this, Mickey. This is a big deal. So I did this, if I talked about on my second channel, the videos that get continual hits are the video that I said that the Springfield XD is not as good as its fanboys want it to be. That's number one. Number two, recently I just put up a video about shotgun pistols. You know, the Smith & Wesson Governor Torch Judge. And oh my gosh, you know, people are like, how dare you? You clearly are an idiot. And so I tell folks all the time, listen, why would you, for your average YouTuber in the gun industry, you know why they don't put up negative reviews? Because they can't deal with the hate. Yeah. Because the fanboys show up, and when we talk about in the Second Amendment community, we lament cancel culture that, you know, but it's alive and well on our team too, because if I say something mean about your purchase, then how dare you? When I say, for instance, dude, if you want to buy a $500 Palmetto State Armory AR-15, okay, just understand when you bring it to class and we run 350 rounds through that carbine in a day, it's probably going to go down. I'm not saying your baby's ugly or your mom's fat. I'm just saying that's probably not going to last through a day of training.
Yeah.
But that frustrates people. And so most guys would never put up a video like you did about that Taurus, because the haters coming your way just make life difficult. And
I think,
and you go,
the other thing was, it wasn't my intent. Like, I didn't, in that video, I even state, I have another Taurus pistol. It's I think it's called a TX-22. It's a very inexpensive, like less than $200 .22 semi-automatic pistol. I don't know how long it will last. It seems to be built very lightly, but it's very nice to shoot. It's pleasant to shoot. So in the video, I say, hey, I don't hate Taurus. I have this other Taurus. Here it is. Like, $200. It's a great little plinking gun, but this one is a piece of garbage. Like, that's the end of sorry.
What do you want me to say? I did the same thing. So Springfield sent me a Hellcat, right? And they sent it to me after my video it's got several hundred thousand views, that I call the Springfield XD the McRib of handguns. Like, you know, the McDonald's McRib sandwich meets the definition of food, but it's objectively not good food. Yeah. But it has this crazy cult following. Same thing with the XD. Well, Springfield was, as they know that exists, and their marketing folks were like, hey, we're coming out with the Hellcat. We'd like to send you one. Are you sure? Yes, we're sure. Okay, understand. If you send it to me, I'm going to be honest about it. Yeah, please. We think it's a great gun. Sure, send me one. So, I mean, I shot it. I put a couple thousand rounds through it, right? And one of the things that I found out is to me, I said, look, I have big, meaty hands. And so for me, gun shot fine, ran reliably. Even with the extended magazine on it, I can't quite get my pinky on the gun. And that to me is a requirement for a fighting pistol. I need to be able to get a full firing grip on the gun and a full fighting grip on the gun. And I just can't with my big hands. Now, if you don't have these big beefy hands like mine, your hands are not quite as big as mine, probably be fine. Well, then my wife, who saw that gun and was like, that's going to be my gun. I'm going to carry that gun. That gun right there looks like the right size for me. I'm like, cool, that's great. So let's take you to the range and shoot it. Well, she found out she has these little thin birdie fingers, and she went to go put her finger on the trigger, and the way that they've designed the trigger safety shoe, she couldn't get it to remove unless she changed her finger position on the gun. So every time she'd draw the gun and try to fire it, it was locked up. And I'm like, oh, that's a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. Like, I would never have found that myself because that doesn't apply to me, but it does apply to you. And so I said on my reviews, I was like, look, if you have little tiny thin fingers, you want to go rent this gun before you shoot it because you could have this problem too. And if you do, this gun is an absolute no-go. And I said, if you have big meaty hands like mine and 40% of your grip strength comes from your pinky, I really want my pinky on that gun. And it just doesn't quite do it for me. So if you have really big hands or really small hands, this gun's probably not right for you. But for the vast majority of people, it's probably fine. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, then that people are like, well, how dare you, you idiot. You don't need your pinky to shoot a gun well. And I'm like, but I mean, it makes you objectively better. I can show you that in every capacity that you know, pinky pressure on your handgun makes all the difference in the world if you can get it.
Right.
But God forbid, you're just a hater. Yeah, you're just a hater. No, I'm not a hater. I'm just trying to bring you good information. Like, and when you do that, it's going to bring the haters out, man. It just is.
It's an interesting phenomenon. I bet you back in the like cavemen days, we probably did it too. But like we wrap up our worth in the things we buy. William April and I talked about this once. Like, I'm not a sports guy, but you like XYZ team, I like the other. And you're an asshole because you like them. Or you like Chevy and I like Ford. I know you drive a Mustang, so you're a Ford guy. But like guys, and that's just like jokes, you know, like you see guys.
It's just fun, whatever.
Yeah. But when it comes to guns, man, dudes get irate.
Yeah, I think that we get this idea that people get their personal worth wrapped up in it. And wait a minute, if I bought something that isn't good, then that reflects on my character and my mm-hmm. intelligence and my personhood. Yeah. And I tell folks all the time, like, you're right. Okay, so I drive a 17 Mustang GT Performance with some upgrades in it. But I'm not like, when people say, oh, you're a Ford guy, I'm really not. I mean, I don't care. It's a car.
I just mean like you purchased one, so you're not
in. Yeah, I purchased one. I drive it. I love my Mustang. His name's Trigger. It's a great car. But guess what? I've got a pre-order on a Cybertruck too, a tri-motor Cybertruck. Cool. And when people are like, are you going to really buy that thing? Dude, have you seen the specs on that car? Yeah, I'm absolutely going to buy that thing when it shows up. Okay, fine. And people are like, are you going to trade your Mustang in on that? Yeah, man, I'm not loyal to that stuff. And listen, if you buy something, straight up, my wife drives a 2012 Fiat 500. Okay.
And a little tiny thing, right?
Yeah, a little tiny little bitty thing. And hers has done really well. It's a fine car, but we bought the Mopar lifetime warranty on it when we bought it brand new. So she bought it new, and it was like $2,000 for her to buy the Mopar lifetime warranty. And guess what? We've already had, $5,000 or $6,000 worth of work done on that car under the warranty. Mm-hmm. It's had a new transmission put in it. It's had, right now, in fact, had a radio go down. And so, you know, they're getting a new one.
How dare you say anything bad about this car? How dare you share objectionable facts that you actually have data on? You must hate Fiat and Chrysler.
Well, and I said, people, look, my wife's has done pretty well and she likes it. Okay. And she drives it. It's got 160,000 miles on it. But if you go look at the consumer reports on that car, it's a raging piece of crap. Uh-huh. That model is, Consumer Reports is like, wave off, God help you. And I will tell people all the time, and the end of things was a mistake. We shouldn't have bought it. But because at least we bought it with the warranty, it's okay. And she likes it. So fine, whatever. It gets her around A to B, has never stranded her anywhere. So okay,
her does car its job. Is like the SIG 3P, the P365, which I love this gun. That also got tons of hate. I've got four of these with over 50,000 rounds through. It's like the same thing. It comes out, they all break, but I still like it. Now it's not broken anymore. They fixed
it. Now, you know, after a while, after SIG does their quality testing, their beta testing on their consumers, now it works okay.
yeah. But my point being, like, same thing. I did a video on this gun. It broke. I was in a Gabe White class, and we were filming it. I shot this through Gabe's class, and it it broke in the class, and it was like, oh, cool. It was on film, like when it was happening. So I went out to the table and broke it down, and, you know, the firing pins cracked. And we talked about it on the video, and people are like, what a piece of shit, blah, blah, blah. You know, SIG should die. And it's like, well, no, it's a machine. And I ran the snot out of it, and it broke. Like, that, it's not meant for that. And stuff breaks, but I still like it. So it's it's an interesting discussion point. People with guns, go ahead.
How many rounds did you have down the pipe of that gun when it broke?
Probably, I don't want to misquote it because it was in the video, it was thousands.
Okay, so I tell people all the time, the vast majority of people will never run 1,000 rounds through a gun, let alone thousands, plural, through a gun.
Thousands.
So, you know, that's like me. I had my first HK VP9 at about 15,000 rounds. The gun got a little crunchy, okay?
Yeah.
The trigger got a little crunchy. And I was like, this is a little odd. And I had another one that I was shooting with a dot on it anyways. And I called them. And I was like, hey, guys, the trigger on this gun's getting a little crunchy. And they're like, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? And I was like, it's just got a hitch. I mean, it still works, but it's got a little hitch in it. And they're like, oh, gosh, send it in. How many rounds has it got through it? I said, about 14,500 right now. Oh, we'd love to see that. We never get to see guns with that much use.
Sure, sure. That's a lot of money.
The funny part was, the funny part was, so now, okay, I'm HK's brand ambassador, right? Like, they send me guns and money. I send it back to him. I get a call from the maintenance guy, from the tech, like 2 days after it gets there. And he's cracking up. He's like, John, when's the last time you like took this gun apart and cleaned the frame? And I'm like, I don't know. Clean guns. I mean, I lube it, but who cleans guns? And he's like, dude, the entire bottom part of the frame is so caked full of freaking like belly button lint. And I pulled all the belly button lint out of it, blew it all out and put it back together. And it runs like a top.
And I'm like, a bunch of pubes stuck in your gun.
Yeah, that's gross. Like, okay, well, maybe I should do that a little more frequently. Okay, but dude, I've been carrying it for like 2 years and shooting the crap out of it, right? And listen, stuff is going to break. You put, 15,000 rounds. I have a P30 that I shot the front sight off of. And people are like, oh, it's a piece of crap. And I'm like, dude, the front sight fell off at like 18,000 rounds.
That's the interesting thing about gun guys. They look at this tool, when you think about it, what are they, $300, $400, $500, $600, $1,000, and it's all these moving parts, and for the most part, even the cheap ones work pretty good, and we expect them to be like this perfect machine. Like, we don't expect a coffee maker to do that, or a toaster.
Right.
And people are like, well, you don't bet your life on a coffee maker, but still, it's made by dudes in a factory somewhere. It's like, it's a machine. It's going to break. It's
gonna break. And
the
funny part to me is, so I have a P30 that I carry right now. I love the limb trigger. And guess what? I have a backup sitting in my gun case every time I go to the range, because it's my carry gun. If I get any hiccups with that gun at all, I have a backup that I know runs fine. I put this one that is giving me a hard time in the box, pick the other one up and keep going. And then we'll figure out what's going on with the broken gun later. Mm-hmm. And because they're gunning, I mean, when you shoot as much as you do, as much as I do, you're gonna break guns. You just are gonna. There's no way around it.
Yeah, it's like a marathon runner. They buy lots of shoes.
Yeah, it's just the way life goes, right? If you put 100,000 miles a year on your car, you're gonna not only go through a lot of oil changes, but you're gonna break parts, and you're gonna expect to do that. Same thing with guns, but just most people don't do that. And on the internet, when somebody says, I've shot thousands of rounds, usually what I do is take whatever round count they say and divide it by 20, and that's probably about
Well, that's the funny thing. So you and I are experts because we have been exposed to so much. Like, neither of us were special operations soldiers or SWAT cops, but we used, like, I talk to guys and they're like, well, that's your opinion. I go, yeah, it's my opinion because, and then they don't like that. And the point I'm about to make is, you said 300 students a year. So if each of those guys only shot 100 rounds of the 300, what are we at, 30,000 rounds? That's a lot of, and it's a lot more than that. So you get to see all of those holsters, all of those guns, all those optics, all those, whatever, even ear pro. Like, I see people with all these things. And so you start to say, okay, that one's a piece of shit. That one's good. That one.
Yeah. This one works well. This one always gives people problems. And then when we correlate that, so then that's why, like, I ask guys like you, or ask others, and I'll say, hey, what are you seeing in your classes? What's happening to you? I've said this recently, that when Smith & Wesson started mass producing shields for like $200. It seemed their quality control went down. So I'm starting to see shields that are just not making it very well anymore. Mm-hmm. The older ones are great, but man, when they start blowing them out for a couple $100, they just don't seem to be working as well.
Yeah.
And people are like, you know, how dare you? Smith & Wesson is a good company. I'm like, dude, I'm just telling you what I see on the line. And we track every single gun that we see on the line. We get objective data from everyone. That's why I post that on my Facebook all the time, right? So here's the guns that we had on the line for this class. And it's an anecdote, but when, you know, at some level, the plural of anecdote does become evidence.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, not immediately, but at some point, and you start going, okay, what are the patterns that we see emerging? What are the things that we see happening here? So, and when you do that and you start correlating with other trainers, guys and gals who are seeing a lot of students, you know, see the average NRA trainer trains one student a year. Cool, that's great. But, you know, we talk to the ones who are training 300, 500, 700. You know, you talk to guys like Carl Wren, who's his school sees 1,000 students or 1,500 students a year. Cool. You know, you talk to the trainers who see 500, 600, 1,000 students a year. I only teach about one class a month, which is why we end up around 300 students, including our national conference. And we track, though, what did we see? What do we go? And those kinds of things. And when you start correlating all that and going, what are all you guys seeing? Now we can start to have some objective data of people who actually shoot their guns, which most people don't.
Yeah. When you have somebody ask, like, and the other part of this is cost. Not everybody can afford fancy stuff, which that's not lost on me. When I was a young man, I couldn't afford to buy diapers and pay the electric bill sometimes. So I get that.
100%.
So, like, I tell folks, go to the local gun shop and see if you can find a turned in Glock. You can go to Glock and buy the whole guts, you know, springs and all for $30, and you've got a great little gun for $200-$300. Like, what do you tell folks when they?
Yeah, I mean, in the day and age when you can get a police trade in Glock for $300, I mean, gracious sakes, is it going to be the prettiest thing ever? No. Hopefully it has a whole bunch of holster wear on it and draw wear from being drawn out of the holster 1,000 times in practice, you know, a week. But you don't have to spend a crazy amount of money. I mean, if you're like, hey, John, I've only got $300 tops, I go, okay, we can get you something that will work in those endeavors, right? In that kind of a price point. But I also tell folks that sometimes your best bet is, I get it, and some folks just can't. But I go, look, man, if I was you, on Saturday morning, I'd put a tank of gas in the lawnmower and start walking around to the neighbors and saying, hey, I've got some things to do. Can I mow your grass for $20? And, you know, in a good day's work, you might be able to make another $100. And now you don't have a $300 budget. You got a $400 budget. And now the world opens up a little bit.
Oh, so you're saying work for it. Nice.
And you know, I mean, I've done that many times. You know, my first gun that I ever bought for my handgun, when I bought my first handgun to carry, we couldn't afford that, man. I was living on a retail manager's salary and a part-time pastor, and we were barely making ends meet, man. Just barely making ends meet. And so there was no extra money. And so when I was like, hey, I think this is important, I want to start carrying a handgun, my wife's like, we can't afford that. And so then I started going and looking for where are some ways I can make some money that we don't have to put in the family budget right now. Made my first $500 teaching a class and used that to buy my first handgun and holster and belt. They were all the wrong choices, by the way, but you know, hey,
I've got a room full of holsters, a room.
Oh gosh, the box of shame. Right. And so, you know, but doing a little extra work, doing something a little extra. I still do that to this day. When I want to buy things and listen, I mean, we're in a pretty good spot financially now, my family, thankfully. And I love kind of being in my mid 40s now. I'm not completely broke anymore, which is amazing. But even now, like when I want to go buy something extra, the family budget is what it is. And it pays for my family to live. And so if I say, hey, man, I want to go buy this cool new shotgun, or I want to go take this class, I got to go make some extra money for that. So that's what I still do. So that's generally what I say. But you're right. I mean, if somebody's only got a few $100, we could probably find you a gun. But dude, a police trading Glock, how do you go wrong with that? It's $30 in springs and a $300 gun, and you've got something that's going to last forever.
Yeah. And you know that you can find a holster and it's going to work and do the job that you need.
Yeah, it'll just work. I mean, for somebody's first gun, like their very first one, I go, you know, listen, you're going to have to work to get me to say, why wouldn't you just buy a Glock 19? Or, you know, I mean, it's just an easy place to start. Mm-hmm. And then maybe in a couple of years, you're going to upgrade and get into this. But if not, like, that gun's going to work forever. You leave it in a sock drawer, it's going to run fine. It's probably the easiest choice.
Bad guys aren't interested in all these other details anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bullet thrower, and it'll throw a bullet just fine. Mm-hmm. And we always say, you know, it's the Indian, not the arrow, right?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's the guy behind the gun in this day and age,
if you're allowed to say that anymore.
Well, maybe I'm not, but I did. So I'm married to a woman who is half Native American, so I'll just claim that as my bona fide. My kids are all part of the tribe, so all have
Indian names. What do you think about what's going on in the world today? So for you guys listening, it's the 1st of July 2020, in case you listen to this in the future.
I think our world's gone a little insane. I think that, you know, you got a perfect storm here of people are scared because of COVID-19. I think they're tired of it too. And that's causing angst and anger. People are worried about their financial future because, you know, so many people out of work and those kinds of things. I was just talking to a person who I love and admire very much who, like, dude, in 3 weeks, my extra CARES Act money expires on my unemployment and I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm homeless at that point because I can't go back to work because I'm not allowed. And what she said straight up, she's like, look, I've told my elected officials, well, on when that expires, I'm going back to work if you don't have another solution for me. And she's not a rebel either. You know, she's just like, look, I either that or I die of hunger. Like, there's just no other options. So I think you got that in a big way. I think obviously Americans are also, I've been studying a lot and doing a lot of reading on human psychology and human thinking and how the brain functions. And we're really good at confirmation bias and at the human brain just, and we all do that. That's not the other side that does that. You do it too. I do it too. Mm-hmm. We look for that which confirms what we already know. And then we make decisions. We really don't use logic to find a rational decision. We make a decision and then use logic to justify that decision. So we're looking for confirmation for what we've done. And we're just absolute pros at that. And when we put all that together in an environment and in a stew where our outrage is being manufactured and packaged and sold for corporate gain, I just think we're in a bad spot for that. And I guess, though, the only thing that I'm hearing, and I'm frustrated watching the news and those things too, but, you know, I had a great discussion not long ago with my wife's grandpa. My wife's grandpa, Fred Westerman is his name. And Fred fled Cuba in the mid 60s as a boy, like literally, like, you know, you see those pictures of people in bathtubs paddling in the, you know, Caribbean looking, heading for Florida. He was one of them. And he earned his citizenship fighting in Vietnam as a Marine and, you know, came over here, fought as a Marine. Now his whole life is doing veteran stuff for Marines. He's retired. When he got out of the Marine Corps, they settled in California. He worked in the printing trade for 45 years after getting out of the Marine Corps as a Vietnam vet. And now he helps other veterans and does veteran stuff. Great guy. And so I was like, Grandpa, what do you think of all this stuff? And you know what he said? He said, it feels very much like the late 60s to me, John. He said, it feels very much like what happened then with big, great civil unrest. And you know, Brown versus Board of Education was in the 50s, was supposed to desegregate schools. You realize that it's not until the 80s that many schools were desegregated, even though Brown versus Board of Education was 54, right? And kind of boggles my mind that I went to elementary school in the early 80s, and those kids, my black friends, some of them, that's the first time that their family had ever had public education that was desegregated. You know, their kid going to school, the white kid, they might've been first. So anyways, back to, you know, late 60s, they're still fighting those fights and tired of that. We should have made more progress by now. And when you combine that with anger and fear from COVID and the polarization of political opinions and confirmation biases, you just get a bad spot. But Grandpa said, you know what happened eventually is we did make some changes and we got tired of the filthy, bitter fighting. and we made it. And and he said, I'm pretty confident that the same will happen, that we're going to have some rough days ahead and there's going to be some unsettled times, but we'll be better at the end of it. And that really encouraged me from a man who's been around the block a time or two, you know, and really seen some stuff. And of course, the interesting thing there, Grandpa being a Cuban and a brown guy in a white world, and married a full blood Native American woman, who Grammy, my wife's grandmother is who named all of our kids, gave them their Indian names.
Oh, cool.
And so they have both names on their birth certificate, you know, white people names, and then they have Indian names in the tribe too. And he said, no, it's a pretty cool place to be. And even with its faults, I'm proud to be an American. And I think we can do both. I think that we as Americans can say, we want to get better. We want to encourage growth and change. And I think we do need to change in some ways, but at the same time, we can recognize it still is better than anywhere else on earth. But I still want to get better, even though it is better. You know, yeah. I travel the world. I love to travel the world. I'm not one of those guys that won't go somewhere because I can't carry a gun. Mm-hmm. My wife and I travel literally the world. And I will tell you, as much as I love other places, I always come home. And the reason for that is because I love it here, even with its faults. But I look at around at some stuff and go, yeah, we could change some things.
Sure, sure. But it all lies in the heart, doesn't it? Like all this stuff.
100%, man.
Yeah, you can legislate whatever you want, but at the end of the day, you can't make a law to change what's in a man's heart. And that's the part that I think people have to get over. I've had these discussions with folks that I care about, and regardless of what we have laws that we can't murder, but people murder. We have laws that we can't steal, but people steal. So you can make laws.
I think that we get these cyclic reminders. You know, I remember back on 9/11, I was on active duty on 9/11, and it boggles my mind today that there are adults out there in the world who were not born yet.
Yeah.
When 9/11 happens. But I always tell folks that 9/11 wasn't as important as 9/12. That on the day after, everybody was looking out for each other, right? Everybody was calling in, hey, you okay? Is everything all right? Do you need anything? The lines at the Red Cross to donate blood were out the door. And all of a sudden we came together and we said, no, let's take care of each other again and hug your loved ones tight. You know, fast forward when the pandemic started and all of a sudden we're on lockdown. And then, you know, oh, I can't find any TP. You know, there's this scarcity problem. And then I remember neighbors in my neighborhood walking around checking on each other. You okay? Do you need anything? You've got enough TP? You got a gallon of milk? You know, you covered? You all right? You sick? Can we help you? And how good that was. And that was, hey, in these tough times, we come together. Now with this whole, the racial unrest in America right now, that's struggling to pull apart a little bit. But on local levels, we can do the opposite. I think where it comes down to is caring enough and saying, hey, what's going on in your world? So that's like me. Okay. So as an old fat white guy, you know, as the one that is in that place where a lot of my contemporaries are, you know, hunkering down and getting together with other old fat white guys, I say, look, reach out instead to your black friends. Are you doing okay? You know, what's going on in your world? How can I help you?
Yeah.
How can I, you know, tell me the story that's going on in your head right now. I want to understand your perspective and help me. Can you help me? Cause I'm literally that ignorant that I'm so stupid. I don't even know what questions to ask. Can you help me? Tell me what you're seeing right now. And I think if we do that, it matters a lot. And
listen is what we're saying. Listen to people.
Yeah. And if you got a friend, like I got friends who I joke, my wife's a home birth midwife. And so, I joke all her friends are like super crunchy pot smoking witch hippies, and listening to those people and going, okay, we're probably on opposite sides of the political spectrum. I'm you know, a libertarian kind of lowercase L live and let live guy. But I don't understand your world, but come on, sit down. Let's have a glass of wine. I just want to hear from you. Tell me what you're seeing today. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to argue with you. I just want to hear from you. I go, oh man, that's somebody who I know and love who thinks that way. And they're a good thinking human being. I just disagree with some of their conclusions, but that's okay. It's okay. I love you. I had an elder at my church.
Go ahead.
I had an elder at my church. He was a lifelong Democrat, you know, a lifelong voting Democrat. And we used to give each other a hard time that every presidential election that would come along, we'd be like, hey, we're canceling out each other's votes, huh? And but we'd have discussions about it. He's like, man, this is why I'm going to vote this way. And this is what's important to me. And this is why I think that we have to do that. And here's how I see Jesus at work. And I'm like, okay, well, okay. and when you do that, I think it's a big deal.
That's the interesting thing about this segment of society that you and I work in and around is on one end of the spectrum, it's liberty, liberty, freedom, freedom. But then over here, it's as long as your expression of liberty and freedom coincides with my way of thinking. If not,
that's right.
You're a piece of garbage and you're a tyrannical, you know, red coat, boot licking, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, wait a second. Like the whole idea of liberty, and you said you study history, and I'm a huge fan of history because we see what was. So many guys that populate the internet looking at the content you put out. I'm constantly challenging people. Go study American history because you'll see these guys had duels and shot each other and hated each other and screamed and yelled, arguing. Yeah. And it wasn't even about heady things like slavery. It was about things like whether or not we should have a constitution or not have a constitution. Like, I think people just don't have a concept of where we came from. But anyway, to the point, you and your friend from church, that's how it's supposed to be. I disagree with you. I mean, you shoot HKs. I don't. I hate them. I think they're junk. I'm just joking.
You poor soul.
Just wanted to be a jerk. But, you know, like it's the same thing as the gun classism is if you don't agree with my political ideologies, you're a bad human. It's weird.
It is weird. And, you know, that's why I try to cross those lines as often as I can, you know, and I say, for instance, you know, I have friends all through the political spectrum. I consider myself friends with my good friend David Yamane, a professor at Wake Forest University. He owns Gun Culture 2.0. That's his blog. And a card-carrying liberal gun owner. And I'm friends with the president of the Liberal Gun Club. And people all across the spectrum. And let me tell you a story about that, Mickey. I have a friend, Piper, who I met Piper, and it probably a lot of people know her. She's the head of Armed Equality. I didn't know her at all, though. And so I was doing a seminar in San Diego, and this woman pops up and at the end and introduces herself and oh, hey, it's nice to meet you. That's cool. And oh, I'm the head of Armed Equality. Oh, great. That's awesome. Let me, you know, let's talk about that. For those who don't know, Armed Equality is the largest LGBTQ gun rights organization in America, probably. And oh, great. That's awesome. And we talked for a while and she said, John, why did I expect you to hate me? I said, I don't know. Why'd you expect me to hate you? Well, I mean, you're a pastor and I'm LGBT. And I was like, and like, keep going. Cause I'm waiting for something I'm supposed to hate. Look, you have the right to defend yourself and you're made in the image of God. And I will absolutely stand with you that you have all the same rights that I do. And if you want to talk about what the book says and how we should live, I'm happy to sit and talk about what the book says and how we should live. But the book says, first and foremost, we love one another. Mm-hmm. And we that's the definition of tolerance, is being able to say, I love you when we disagree. And I consider her a friend today. And we've had many discussions and we disagree about a lot of stuff, even stuff within the Second Amendment community. And there have been times where I've had to nudge her a little bit and go, hey, maybe a little much, maybe come this way instead. And she's nudged me about things. Hey, John, maybe you're not seeing this correctly. Okay, cool. And that's the kind of thing that I think being an adult means, is being able to grow next to people you disagree with. But I think instead we tend to get into echo chambers and mutual admiration societies. And because we set up these boundaries, here's what the tribe is and here's the signals of the tribe. And if you don't have all the signals, well, then you're out. The no true Scotsman fallacy. And instead I go, nah, man, I view the tent as broad and I want to be able to, who's me, you know? I asked my conservative Christian friends, how many Muslim friends do you have? like legit practicing Muslim friends? Right. How many atheist friends do you have? How many pagan, legit pagan friends do you have? Not like non-believing friends, like folks who worship the Norse gods do you have? how many Wiccans do you know and love and would have a meal with? And I try to have all of those because they're me too, right? They're part of my people. And when we, I think if we do that, I think then that's where the real change happens.
Comes back to what I was talking about earlier. What's your goal? Like, and I think some folks genuinely are happy to surround themselves with people that are just like them. And if that's what floats their boat, fine. But you can't hate people for being different. That's a weird thing. That's it's actually.
Well, you can, but you shouldn't.
Yeah. Agree. Yeah, that's a better way of saying it. You definitely can, but it's a really immature, small-minded thing to do.
I tell folks all the time, you have the right to be an asshole if you want to, but you shouldn't be.
Sure.
And if we're going to make it as a society, the people that I want to be around are the people who are not. The people who can disagree with somebody agreeably, who can coexist in a libertarian republic and go, look, man, freedom for me means freedom for thee. Mm-hmm. And I'm down with that. And you get to be you and I get to be me. And where our boundaries overlap, we can exist together. And where they don't, we don't even have to exist together. You can exist in your own space and I can exist in my own space. And that's cool.
I dig that. Let's talk a little bit before I have to let you go about your YouTube channel, just because that's what people know you for broadly. How did you get into this thread of analyzing video footage of violent encounters or shootings things of that nature?
I got into it because of my own training. So what happened was it's a combination of social media and my own training. So I was 2014, Facebook, actually, the business really started on in social media on Facebook. And for a while there, I was making these high quality memes, you know, because Facebook was all about memes for a while. It's still about memes, but it was really about memes. And I was making self-defense memes just to kind of build my business page that would have a high quality picture of a firearm or somebody holding a gun or something, you know, like old Volt takes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And put a quote or a thought or an idea on it. And then those were great. And then Facebook in late 14 started allowing videos. You could upload a video. That was new, and we don't think about that now. 6 years later, it's just part of life there, but it was new. And somebody sent me a video of a real-life knife attack of somebody just absolutely shanking his baby mama and who'd broken up with him. And I was like, whoa. So the thing was is that I grabbed my smartphone, took it to my martial arts class that night, and before class, I showed my teacher. I was like, hey, I'm a student of Professor Lawrence Robinson at Attitude First Martial Arts Academy. And I was so on the mat, he's Professor Robinson. In the rest of the world, he's my friend Lawrence. And Lawrence, hey man, I don't know bupkis about defending myself against an attack like this. And I feel like I just haven't seen this in the system yet, or we haven't talked about it or what, but what do we do? And he was like, hey, let's workshop that tonight as our class. Let's just watch it together and then we'll workshop it. And that's what we did. And this was a big knife attack. And we realized, okay, so when somebody attacks you with a knife, it sucks. And when it's extemporaneous, it sucks even more. And that was super instrumental for me and influential, as I was like, oh, wow, this video of what really happened to somebody impacted the way that we trained on the mat. So I posted it to my Facebook page and was like, hey, everybody, pay attention to this. We worked it on the mat tonight. Here's some things to think about. And it went kind of viral. And I was like, wow, okay, so that helped somebody. So then somebody else sent me another video. I posted it. We used it in class. And then very quickly I realized, oh, okay, cool. This actually informs our training. This is what a real life attack kind of looked like, rather than kind of fake McDojo stuff. You know, the guy sticks a knife out at you and then stands there while you beat the crap out of him for 10 minutes. Then what happened, the real aha moment is I had a laptop. Somebody sent me a video that had like 5 minutes of intro of nothing, of literally dead space, and then 30 seconds of action of something happening. And I was like, dude, I know I've got software on my laptop that can cut that out, so then that way I'm not boring people for 5 minutes. But I didn't know how to use it, so I went on YouTube and did a basic tutorial for Adobe Premiere. And in that, it was like, hey, you know, there's a feature on there just in this basic tutorial where you can record audio over that from your laptop. And I was like, really? well, that's interesting. And I tried it and I was like, hey, that was cool. So instead of typing up little reminders in the description, hey, people, watch this and this, I can say it. Hey, everybody, watch this, see this happen in there. But I'm like, that could be like the John Madden of on-camera violence. And posted that first one of those to the Facebook page, and it went nuts. And I was like, okay. And then every time I would use one, I would try to implement that and what the lesson there was into my own training and into my martial arts training, into my firearms training. And because I just try to be evidence-based, I try to say, what is the evidence that I actually need to do? Because there's a lot of myths in firearms use in America, in defensive firearms use, a lot of myths in martial arts, and in empty-headed stuff. And so I just try to make it more there. And then, so then that kind of blew up a little bit. And then in 2016, we had a couple of them on our YouTube channel. We were doing them on Facebook almost every day. And then in April of 16, YouTube sent me an email and was like, hey, you have enough subscribers and enough watch time on your channel that if you want, you can monetize your channel. And then we'll pay you when people watch it. And I was like, dude, that's like walking down the street and finding $5 bills. I'd be stupid not to say yes to that. Yeah. And so I said yes, click the button, you know, set it up. And then I was like, dude, I've made these couple hundred, like 500 videos on the Facebook page that are there. I have them still sitting on my hard drive. I might as well upload a few of them and see how it does. And then I beat my head against the wall because that was where I should have been uploading them the whole time. And it just blew up. So we went from April 2016 that we had about 6,000 subscribers on the channel to, yeah, about probably, I would guess probably today we'll crack 1.8 million on the big channel. And
awesome.
Yeah, so that's how we got into it. And then, I mean, the production value on the early ones stinks. I mean, I didn't wait until I was good at it to start doing it. I just started doing it.
There's a good lesson there, though. I've been self-employed over 20 years, and the people, you wouldn't have figured out how to do it good unless you did it bad or less.
If something's worth doing well, it's worth doing poorly, right?
Yeah,
you don't just get after somewhere. It.
Yeah, the sermon that you give somewhere today would not be as good as, or would be much better than the sermon you gave 15 years ago.
Oh gosh, man. I listened to some of those old ones and I'm like, oh kid, what are you doing? But,
And furthermore.
So yeah, I mean, you know, that's how we started it. And then it's just kind of blown up from there. And, I've really worked probably the last 5 years, especially really hard to be highly qualified to do that and to be better at it. Mm-hmm. A couple years ago, I begged, Dr. Bill Lewinsky to let me go through Force Science Institute's Force Science Analyst. And he had not led a non-sworn through that class in over a decade. And no, we're working on cop stuff. And I'm like, but Dr. Lewinsky, this is what I'm doing. Please, yeah. I need your knowledge. And so he, okay, John, I'll allow it. And the fun part of that is that really refined what I was able to do. It gave me more insights. It didn't negate anything that I was used to that I had said, sure, but it added so much more depth and nuance and those things. I'm trying to clear some space. He has an advanced force science analyst certification, but it's a beast of a class.
I was supposed to do that this past year and did the time commitment. I just couldn't carve it out. I can't.
That was me too.
Yeah.
That was me too. When you're talking, okay, I got every other week a WebEx meeting and I've got 20 hours a week or something for the next 20 weeks of work. And I'm like, whoo, doggy, that's no joke, man.
Yeah. I had just finished a 6-month commitment at the local college, and I'm like, I can't bite that off, man. Like, the grass is growing, the paint's peeling on the house. I can't do it.
Yeah. That was me too, but I'm talking about it in 2021, and the CEO of Active Self Protection, Stephanie Widener, she's getting Force Science Institute certified as a Force Science Analyst. Cool. This year. So it's one of those things, man, where then working to say, Am I giving good advice? That's really what I'm really worried about, because my responsibility is to the people who pay attention to me, who trust me as an advisor, to give them good advice, because lives are at stake.
Sure.
So, you know, I work really hard on my own skills, because I am not going to be that guy that gets killed in a gunfight because I was a doofus.
Uh-huh.
I think that would negate everything that I've done. And listen, if I get killed in a gunfight, anybody can get beat any given day, right? But at the very least, I'm gonna make that dude pay retail.
Sure.
And same thing, if some guy attacks me with his hands, like, I recognize I can get my butt kicked like anybody else can. Anybody can lose any given fight, but at least I'm gonna make him pay full retail for it. And in that same way, so then, is the advice good advice? That's what I want to give. I want to give the best advice to give people the best chance to make it.
I dig that. What kind of advice would you have for somebody? So you're hyper aware of this, and I'm sure you get messages constantly. So I ran a non-for-profit for working for gun rights for a number of years based out of this area. And at that time, none of this stuff existed on the internet, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And so now it's like almost a model, right? Go get a camera, get a microphone, get a dude. I remember, you remember this too, like 8, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, you had to be very hyper aware for the viewer of pointing the gun at the camera, because there'd be a bunch of comments like, well, your cameraman's, you know, getting guns pointed at him. Like, it's a tripod. Yeah. There's nobody.
You know, right. So you're right.
Now we're
My so camera aware. Got a gun pointed at it.
Yeah. Now, like, now it's like we're used to that. Now, okay, guys with cameras and guns, it has become a normal thing. Anyway, my point is there's tons of dudes that want to do this model of, I love shooting guns. I want to, this makes me feel a certain way. So I want to start, you know, Joe's Badass Gun Training Company. I want to go get a camera and I'm going to do all of this. And then the guys will ask me, and my question's coming, like, hey, how do I do what you do? And I go, well, why do you want to, for one? And your point, this is where I'm going with this, you're actually training yourself so that you have the information to pass on. It's not, it's not, I just want to pass on information. It's, I have information to pass on. So what advice do you have for dudes or dudettes that are wanting to jump into this instructional field with firearms and weapons?
I'm all about, we need more and better instructors, right? So there's a crazy demand, and right now especially. And so I think, great, if you want to go, but don't go and try to teach to the edge of your abilities and your knowledge. I think that's one of the big things that I see that's a big mistake, that people go, oh, I took a class, so now I can teach that class. No. A true firearms teacher has a depth of knowledge that goes so far beyond the class that they're teaching that you never get to see. And so otherwise you're just parroting. So like when you go get your NRA instructor certs, you are certified to repeat their curriculum, and that's it. That's all you've got. So it's good for what it is, because it's an introduction, right? It's an entry step. But so yeah, go take that. And then what I would really tell, if you want to get into the firearms instruction business, two things. Number one, train broadly yourself. So that means getting out from the school that you're in, because as Tom Gibbons says, schools turn into puppy mills real fast. And everybody, you know, you got the same gene pool. This generation teaches the next generation teaches the next. And if you never get any fresh input, it becomes real stupid real fast. You start to see some real genetic deficiencies. So train broadly, get outside your school. That's why I seek out folks from all over the industry. And I still got to get into one of your classes, Mickey, but I'm going to do it. I promise you.
Sure. You'd be fun.
So train broadly, get in under a bunch. And every time you show up to class, show up as the best student, the student you want 20 of on your line. I'm here to learn. I'm prepared. I'm resourced appropriately, and I am ready to learn. I don't have all the answers. I'm not here to feed my ego. I'm here to build my knowledge base. So that would be absolutely number one. Number two, find a great teacher of firearms and apprentice under them a while. And that means going and being an assistant instructor for them. That means pasting targets so that you can watch them teach and coach and mentor and guide. You know, that means sweeping brass at the end of the day. That means being willing to be a servant and not a leader. But if you do that, and especially if you do that on a couple. So every time I show up to class, I'm looking not only halfway as a student for what, you know, skills they're teaching me, but how are they as a teacher? What are some of the things that I can glean from them? Yeah. I'll give you a great, for instance, I just took a class in May with Tim Heron. I took his pistol shooting solutions class. And Tim is probably the best I've ever seen at individually coaching students while teaching a group class.
That's cool.
Just an absolute master of that. And giving students individual feedback in class. And in fact, we instantly took something that Tim does and put it in our classes because I love the idea so much. And so I think if somebody wanted to get into the instructor world, do those two things. Train broadly, so you got broad-based understanding, a deep knowledge, not just superficial knowledge of the subject. And then apprentice if you possibly can. Now, if you're like, look, I'm in an area, there's nobody here who's a firearms instructor. Well, you might have to get in the car and drive a little bit. But
yeah, you got to work.
You got to work for that, right? Yeah. But a lot of the national folks, if you said, hey, I'm going to come and take your class, they're like, cool. And then after you sign up, like, hey, where are you teaching next? Can I show up and just be a range monkey for you? Most of those folks, guys and gals, like the national folks, like, what, you want to tape targets and pick up brass and help me through that? Yeah, I'm in. Like, I'm cool with that. Like, I can't pay you, but no, I just want to watch and see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm totally down with that. And if you do that, then that will get you, I think, started on the right foot.
Paul Sharp and I talk about this a lot. I don't disagree with anything you just said. It's nobody go to a doctor or to a lawyer or even a butcher that like just taught themselves something in the last month. Yeah, I'm going to represent you in court. What law school did you go to? Well, I really didn't. I read some mystery novels and I kind of got a good idea what's going on. Like nobody would do that. But for some reason in this space where life and death are on the line, a lot of folks just kind of look at the sexy factor of it, shoot guns, make cool videos, high speed, you know, boom, boom. And it's
right.
It's sign me up, which.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I mean, and some folks like that, they want to be an Instagram operator and shoot the high speed, cool guy stuff. I prefer to be an educator instead. And sometimes the cool guy stuff is really fun. You know, I like Tactical Fantasy Bandcamp, like the next guy. But at the same time, I'm like, hey, I want to teach this stuff. Like I'll show on my YouTube channel terrible runs. You know, hey, I'm going to run this drill. And then I run it and I just absolute hosed it. You know, it's just the worst sure. run ever. And I go, well, that's a fail.
Yeah.
Let's try that again.
Makes you real.
You know, that's me.
Clearly the proof is, well, I was going to say the proof's in the pudding. I kind of have a simpleton in the cause and effect realm. If your channel's growing, your reach is growing, you've put a ton of hard work in, and so you're reaping the benefits. New house, fast car. Yeah, exactly. Guns showing up to the house. So life is good. I appreciate you taking the time. I usually wrap up a podcast and I'll say, give you the final word and I'll say goodbye after the fact. But if you never met the people listening or watching us, if you guys never cross paths in life or again online, what would you leave them with?
If I left, you know, the people that are going to be listening to this are self-defenders. They're folks who are interested in, they're about that life, probably. Probably don't have a whole lot of casuals. So I would say more than anything else, don't forget to live a life worth defending. Don't forget in your, you know, okay, so I'm going to go and become, you know, all centered on my jiu-jitsu training, or I'm going to train like a dog for the fight. Okay, I'm down with that. Like, I'm right there with you. But don't forget to live a life that's worth defending. Love your wife, love your husband, love your kids, enjoy life. Go out and have a great meal every once in a while. See the world. Do something epic. Don't just be a badass. Live an epic life. Now, an epic life doesn't have to be an exorbitant life. It doesn't have to be, oh, I make all the money and I do all the cool guy things. No, you know, at the end of the day, if your life mattered to somebody, that'll do it. And so just don't get so immersed in training for that worst day that you forget to live a life that's worth living.
I dig that, man. I couldn't said that any better myself. I think sometimes we end up not seeing the forest through the trees, right? And that's kind of what you're talking right. about. We get so wrapped up in the physical stuff that we forget why we've done it and why we're doing it. And so I tell my kids I'm going to die and there's a room full of guns and gear that whatever takes me, that stuff's still sitting there. So sell it and buy a sailboat.
Absolutely.
Or whatever suits you. I appreciate you taking the time, John. You guys listening, if you have not subscribed to John's YouTube channel, Active Self Protection, you should check it out. There's tons of You got hundreds of videos there now, right? Maybe even.
Yeah, about 2,000 actually.
Oh, I was going to say maybe even thousands. So thousands of videos. You could literally kill thousands of hours catching up on all of his past stuff. You can even go deep and see the stuff that he's not proud of, which I think is. I got some of those too. It's good stuff. Got to start somewhere. I appreciate
it. That's right. Hey, you guys, thanks, man. I appreciate you, Mickey.
If you guys dug, thank you. If you guys dug this episode of The Higher Line, share it. Put it on your Facebook page or wherever. Share it with your friends that you think might get something out of it. There is no easy path to anywhere worth going. And I think that's a good spot to end it. This was brought to you by Gunfighter Gun Oil. Be well. Don't be dickheads. Visit our website, kerrytrainer.com, for information about classes held throughout the U.S., Kerry Trainer apparel, and upcoming projects. You can also email us at training@kerrytrainer.com for information about setting up your own private course or speaking engagement. training@kerrytrainer.com or kerrytrainer.com.